You're listening to Highlights from One Planet podcast interview with Paul Hawken, a visionary environmentalist and entrepreneur of Project Regeneration and Project Drawdown. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
Because we talk about it like carbon is the problem, it's the culprit, it's the bad boy to civilization going on, and somehow we have to fix it and combat it and tackle it and do all these things to it. Instead of realizing and knowing that carbon is a flow, it's the flow of life itself from all the oceanic and marine life, living systems all the way down to the bottom of the oceans and to the surfaces with phytoplankton, and the same on land. And there's 3.4 trillion creatures, and we're 8.1 billion. And we treat them as if they're not even there, or we treat them as if we'll take you, we can eat you, we can do something with you, we can make something of you, or you're in the way like an insect and we'll kill you. And that is what has to change. And regeneration really is about the recognition that all of life is inherently regenerative. And we have to recognize and admit and to ourselves that, particularly since the colonists 500 years ago, since 1492, but really we have been degenerating the world, extracting, taking anything we wanted from whomever, including people, whenever we wanted, and then to create wealth and concentration of money and so forth. And what I'm saying regeneration is that everyone can read those headlines you talked about and the extreme concern that scientists are expressing right now. And they're very conservative when they actually express something that way because they are scientists. And everybody can read that. And what that says is another way to look at that is that the road we're on, which is a degenerative road, you can see the end of it. You can see the end. Like, it doesn't go much further. The incremental understanding of science and predictions made at Stanford Research Institute in the 70s. And everything I learned then is all we needed to know now, actually. It's not like something we figured out between 1970 and today that gives us great insight as to cause and cure. We knew what the cause was. What we didn't talk about then was the cure, what to do about it. And for almost 40 years after that, there was really nothing out there about what a person could do or a city could do or a college or a company or all the different levels of agency that are acting upon the earth. And there was really nothing out there, which I found really surprising. And we sent staff, we had started Project Drawdown at that time, but we sent staff to the Paris Conference of the Parties in 2015. And just for fun, we asked people, what are the top five solutions to the climate crisis? We would say to reverse global warming. That's what drawdown means. People generally are busy working on everything they need to do that day. Most of the world really have to tend to food security, income, warmth, clothing, children, schooling, health. You just go down the list. And that takes up the whole day. And 5.1 billion people really wake up every morning with current existential threat. And you lob in future existential threat like those articles. They have not the wherewithal, the time to deal with that because they're focused on making it from that day to the next or 1 week to the next. And that's the vast majority of human beings on the planet. And you couple that via the fact that the climate movement in its enthusiasm and its literacy has devolved into jargon, complete jargon. In other words, go talk to somebody, I'm not going to name any place, but just a person, say, who isn't involved, and ask them what climate neutrality means, or ask them what net zero means, or ask them what decarbonization means. And I can go on and on. We've lost a great deal of our forests in the last 200 years. In fact, we've lost half of all life on the planet in the last 100 years. The losses are accumulating and increasing rates. So the fact is that forests have been decimated, and yet there are 5 megaforests left on Earth, and the Amazon, the Congo, Borneo, Indonesia, and the boreal forest, which is circumnavigate the polar region, the Arctic, from Russia to Taiga, all the way to Canada and Alaska and Scandinavia. And those forests are extraordinary carbon sinks. And one of the things we know, because you probably heard, as did many people, we should plant 1 trillion trees. Sounds good. That would be the worst thing we could do. I'm not saying planting trees is bad, but planting trees, what trees? Where? Because the nature doesn't plant trees, it plants forests. And forests are very complicated, beautifully complex configurations of plants and shrubs and trees and animals, all of which creates this richness that we see in megaforests. So again, I feel like in some cases we oversimplify things. Human beings have interacted with forests for tens of thousands of years to make them more prolific, to make them healthy, to preserve them, and to prevent what we saw last year in Canada, which is forest fires just sweeping through broad areas. That was caused by us, not by the weather, not by fire. We dried out that forest ourselves because we had 400 million beavers, castores, in North America. And the Hudson Bay Trading Company killed almost every one of them down to 400. Now they're back, but they wetted the land. They built lakes and dams and they stopped streams. And so because we were seeing trees as individuals, like we see ourselves, which we're not individuals either, but we have that illusion. The land was wetter when beavers were populating all of Turtle Island, which is what the Native Americans call America, Canada. And we created that desiccation. We created that condition for dryness. We created the conditions where you plant the same tree in forests and we cut it down there. We used to plant the same tree. Suzanne Samar talks about that too. But the trees were individuals and they weren't interacting. And what we know now, it's not just trees, but every single living organism on the planet is interacting with the other ones in ways that we're just discovering. And what I love about, I would say, the current wave of science is we're discovering mystery. It's not just you can name everything, so therefore you not understand it. No, the names don't mean anything. What means something is the interactions, the unfathomably complex relationships that we see in the living world. And so regeneration is saying, look, we've got to get that carbon thing right. We can't just keep double glazing the planet. But it was the earth that regulated climate until we started digging up coal, gas, and oil. And it always will regulate the climate. And so if we're not restoring life on earth, we're not serious about climate. I started my first food company when I was in my 20s. It was entirely regenerative and organic, every farm. So I've known farmers for decades and so forth, and some very big farms, some smaller for sure. But I think when we look at ag now, chemical industrial ag, it is oftentimes on very big plots of land, whether it's in France or Iowa or Nebraska, Argentina. And the reason for that is greed. That is, fewer people or persons can make more food or create more food, which creates more money. It does. But it does so at the expense of the land itself and everything that lives upon and underneath it, as you point out. That being said, the difference between regenerative ag on, say, a large plot of land and a monoculture is the difference. And that is, if it's a monoculture, corn or soy, fence to fence, every direction with nothing else, you're going to have problems. In the soil, on top of the soil, on the plants, insects, you're going to have disease, you're going to have all sorts of problems. And we have bred plants over the last 100 years that can do just as well or better in poorer and poorer soils. Now, we bred plants that respond to chemicals and synthetics. And so regenerative farmers do it very differently. And furthermore, they don't monocrop and they alternate. And there, I've been to many of these farms and they plant different crops. They'll plant prairie strips in the Midwest, which are these native grasses, which is a big wide strip of native grasses. And they get better yields if they give up some of the soil to the pollinators and the dung beetles and others and so forth. If they use animals, that is to say plant cover crops and let animals come in and clean it up, that is crop it, huge difference in fertility. And so I can go on and on, but no, a regenerative agriculture doesn't want to be super big because there is an old saying about the farmer has eyes. She or he is, they walk the farm, they know and see what's going on and they make decisions accordingly. So you've got to have eyes on the acre. You have satellites and tractors that are bigger than a house that are mechanized by lasers and computers. Basically, you've turned the earth into a thing, chemical agriculture. Their influence and their propaganda, you're talking about Bayer, Monsanto, Corteva, Syngenta, They control agricultural departments at USDA. They control the rhetoric. They control what journalists think and say and so forth. They don't go to the farms that already exist that predated some of this. And so it's just another way that corporations have grabbed the microphone, whether it's on climate or ag or so forth, and told people, this is what we can do and we're going to do this and we're good guys and all that sort of stuff. And it's just not true. And so it's so you again, you say, show me, I'll point to you, I'll give you the names of the farmers and go see yourself. And when you talk to them, what you're talking to is what farmers should be, which people really know their land. They really know it. And they know that it's different everywhere. And so it's not always the same, the soils that. But that's what chemical ag does. It makes it all the same. It's just a substrate. It's a medium. And you grow things by putting chemicals in. And the chemicals, fertilizers, NPK, et cetera, feed the plants. I think that a lot of times the climate movement doesn't organize itself as a movement, but it is a movement. And it talks about solutions, but it's downstream and it's not upstream. And if you're going to really change something, you want to go to cause, and that there would be the banking, finance, corporate manufacturing system in the world. And there's a wonderful thing by, I think, Bishop Desmond Tutu, I think, talking about being on a river and then seeing people floating down and drowning and going out there and saving people. And then said, maybe we should go upstream and figure out who's throwing them in the river. Okay. And the same thing holds with clothing, with the built environment, transportation, with healthcare, which in this country I would call sick care. It's not healthcare. It's a huge industry. The biggest industry in America is healthcare. And we don't really look at it that we don't look at it in toto. We look at it as I got a prescription or my doctor says I should take this, or I want to get a new shirt, chemise, or blouse. But if you step back and look at these industries that you named, and the military industry is the biggest industry in the world. Who knew? When you really add it all up, which no one ever does, and since I wrote the book and now there's 30 wars going on right this minute, and you think, oh no, it's Gaza and Ukraine. No, those are two. There's many more conflicts going on. And the industry, it feeds the politics of conflict. And in the guise of saying, we want to keep you safe, we're in America, all that sort of stuff. Of course, we want to be safe. But the fact that there's no cabinet post in almost every government in the world about peace, but there's always a defense minister, but it's often not defense, it's offense, or it's both. But we don't have anybody in the governments thinking, okay, this is a conflict and this is that. But look what Paul did in Rwanda. As horrible as that situation was, that's not happening in Rwanda. And somehow he was managed to create peace, a country that was just shredded and ripped apart by brutal killings. And look at the world today. Why is there war? And the interesting thing about war is that it's not caused by resource. People say, oh, it's resource conflicts. This country wants those countries' resources. That's a fable. It's caused by stories. That's what causes war. We have stories about other people, and they have stories about us. And so the media and people who benefit from war are very into stories and propagating those stories and so forth. And then you get the Israeli-Gaza thing. Gazans, Muslims, Jews, they were kith and kin 2,000 years ago. Never would imagine killing or having any. What happened all that time? It's just stories. And so we are heavily divided, and the war industry loves it. And now that puts an emotion on these industries. The people in them just think they're doing the right thing and making better guns, better bombs, better planes, better everything. Where does it stop? It never stops. It will never stop in terms of technology and proliferation. And so if we don't look at that as, and the climate movement, if we don't look at war, don't look at conflict, we don't look at weapons, then again, what I would say is we're not serious. We say, oh, we'll do direct air capture, or we'll drive Teslas around and so forth. But we're not getting to the people who are throwing people into the river. We're not upstream. We're not at the cause of social destruction, of the reification of these stories and identities. And we're not getting to the cause of the loss of the living world. I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying it's much bigger. And what regeneration does, in my opinion, is open up the vistas of possibility. It's not about narrowing it down. It's about the opposite. If you look at the world differently, and you understand really, that all our responsibility, but also our blessing, is to create more life. Who doesn't want to create more life? It's going to be the path forward. It's just a question of whether we'll be part of it or not. It's about belief. And policy really should be created as close as possible to where people live, not far away. It should be created where there's community. And the interesting about regeneration, to me anyway, is that all life exists in community and no place else. They go, how did that happen? No one can explain that. No one, no scientist can explain that. It's almost religious in a way. Like, that's that point where chemistry changes into a being. There's 100,000 sensors on every cell. A sensor senses what? Input information to the cell and transmits it to another cell. So this is the basic structure of life, right? And so we're the same. We live in villages, cities, countries, and so forth. And what's happened, and you talked about it, Mia, and then the post-truth world, is that we're getting atomized. We're getting separated. We're getting divided, even though we live next door to each other, even though we are neighbors, even though we may share the same religious belief or something like that. We're getting divided and separated by technology and by the people who control technology. Policy comes in naturally from consensus and people sharing, listening, talking, wanting to solve problems. That's where it comes from. When you get to institutions as big as the EU or United States Congress, it just doesn't function very well. It as visibly, she does much better than any other place I know of. And it's not that we have to get rid of these things so much as we have to reimagine our communities and what it means to make decisions that relate to the community from the ground up instead of from the top down.
We hope you've enjoyed this program and listening to the highlights of this podcast. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast or learn more about environmental projects, click on the subscribe button. Thank you for listening.